Usually, this is a class on the Middle East, on the role of oil, on the role of imperialism. And then we often do a separate class on Palestine. Because of the big, big developments in Palestine, I want folks to tell me when an hour is up, and we're actually going to switch gears. The two are obviously connected, and we'll see the connection very much. But Palestine, the State of Israel, how it exists, why it exists, is sort of a separate part of this, and I want to make sure we have enough time, and yet it's completely the most relevant point when we're looking at the struggle. Let me just begin by asking Arturo to go over when we gave out the various things. One of the key ones is a chronology of the region. So if it's called U.S. intervention in the Middle East, it's a stapled together piece there. And I want to ask him just to summarize a couple of the key points in this chronology. I don't mean for you to read it all now, because I really think that Arturo here is going to give some of the main points of it.
Good afternoon. Maybe first we'll begin by just kind of going to the map and showing what is the Middle East so we can have an idea. So it's basically from Saudi Arabia all the way to Turkey, and then all the way east to India, to the border of India, and to the south of to the border of Russia. So it includes Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria. Does it include Egypt? It includes Egypt also, which is the Suez Canal right here. Yes? Pardon me? No, it doesn't include Turkey. It does?
Yes.
It does? All right. So that is what is referred as to like the Middle East. And there's, since 1945 to 2001, there's been over 26 attempts, interventions of the U.S., either direct military action, U.S. CIA coup, money spent on counter-revolutionary forces by the from Congress, and threats of nuclear threats. I think I'll begin with 1944, where the U.S., just to kind of put how they're thinking, how the imperialists are thinking, that the U.S. State Department memo says that in the Middle East, there's a great amount, it's a strategic power for of oil. And that's how they view it. For them, is the oil. And in 1946, President Truman threatens to drop the super bomb on the Soviet Union if it doesn't withdraw the troops from northern Iran. And the Soviet Union always was all on the side and was asked to come in. It wasn't like they invaded or anything, but they were asked by the revolutionary forces that were in the area that were fighting against the U.S. Propped up puppet government. The Soviet Union.
Soviet Union. Oh, okay.
In November of 1947, the partition of State of Palestine occurred, and Sarah will go into more of that. In 1948, there was the war that breaks out between Israel, Egypt, Iran, and Jordan, and where most of the Palestinians, it's a huge portion of the Palestinian population is displaced. And Israel occupies the majority of historic Palestine, but it has less than a quarter of the population. And it just occupies. And as soon as that happens, the U.S. recognizes Israel. Bam.
In 49, there's the CIA backs a coup against the popularly elected government of Syria and establishes a dictatorship under Colonel Zaim. I mean, this just repeats. In 53, there's another coup against the Mossack government. And that was because he nationalized the oil. And then the Shah was put in power, and for 25 years, he ruled a dictatorship, brutal dictatorship that was really massacred millions of Iranians. In 56, there was an intervention right after Nasser nationalizes the Suez Canal. The Suez Canal is right here. And before the pipelines, that's how the shipping route was. So most of the oil would come from here, and it was shipped around, and that's how it got to Europe. So that was the route. There were no pipelines before. I mean, this is in the 50s. Now there are pipelines, but still the majority of the oil still goes around. So strategic control of this canal is important, just like it was strategic control of the Panama Canal in Panama. In 57, the CIA the U.S. actually military in the Mediterranean dispatches forces in Lebanon. And the CIA begins making payments to undermine the popular uprisings in Jordan. When the Soviet Union says no intervention and we will support the popular uprisings, the U.S. responds in 58, we're going to nuke you. We have the nuke, you know, we have the bomb. So don't intervene. Let me see. In 1960, the U.S. works covertly to undermine the new government in Iraq by supporting by supporting anti-government Kurdish rebels. And they tried to assassinate the Iraq's leader, which was Qasim. He was pro-Soviet, he was pro-people, and he had actually lifted the ban on Iraq's Communist Party. And the U.S. supports the Ba'ath Party in 63 to overthrow Qasim. They spent money and military aid. Do you want to add something, Sarah? No? Okay. In 66, the U.S. sells military aid to Israel. And why is that? In 67, you'll see that Israel launches the Six-Day War against Palestine and seizes almost the rest of Palestine militarily using U.S. weapons. In 1970, more intervention, U.S. And Israeli backing, they attack the Palestinians. And they drop the napalm. They threaten the Soviet Union if they intervene on the side of the Palestinians. And scores are wounded. And it's a lot of bloodshed. In 73, it's important. The U.S. Gives $2.2 billion in emergency military aid to Israel. After Egypt and Syria reclaimed the land that was theirs in the Golan Heights and Mount Sinai that Israel had taken over militarily. When the Soviet Union says we support the right of self-determination, the U.S. says, you know, we're on DEFCON 3. That means that's the highest alert from nuclear threat. And it forces the Soviet Union to back down. This is time and time again that the worker state would come in on the right, on the side of self-determination, and the U.S., the imperialists, would say, well, you know, we're going to nuke you. We're going to bomb you. We're going to use force to not make that happen, to not allow that. We'll use all military aid. We'll use all our financial support, all our imperialist allies. And this is just repeated and repeated. I'm going to skip a couple. In 79, the U.S. supports Pelham military forces to undermine the government of South Yemen, and which was a pro-communist, or they had ties with the Soviet Union. And Yemen is right down here. In 79, the U.S. finances and tries to save the Shah of Iran from a people's uprising, but it fails because the people were fed up with the Shah selling off all the oil, all the lands to foreign investment capital. In Jimmy Carter in 79, he designates the, this is important because strategically, this is how the U.S. ruling class is looking at it. The Persian Gulf is a vital interest and declares the U.S. will go to war to ensure the flow of oil. The flow. It's not about anything else. It's about the oil. And we see that today. In 79, because the revolution happened in Afghanistan when? In 79? 78? In 78, there was a people's revolution, which was mainly peasant because of the feudal conditions in Afghanistan. It's one of the poorest countries in the Middle East. I think it is the poorest. There was a people's uprising, and they overthrew the monarchy. They invited the Soviet forces or the Soviet Union to come in and help because they didn't have railroads. They didn't have infrastructure. They didn't have anything. It was feudal society in 1979. And because of that, because of the Soviet Union being invited in, Carter puts the U.S. On alert, on nuclear alert, and says, you know, if you're in here, we're going to use the bomb again. It's the threat again of using the bomb. In 1980, there's more military intervention. And this is Turkey and Pakistan. And in September 22, Iraq invades Iran, but both were financed by the U.S. U.S. was giving Iran arms, while they were giving Iraq intelligence, political, and money, political aid. So it was to weaken both nation states so the U.S. at the end could have more control. If they can kill themselves, this is the ruling class, let them kill themselves, and we can control afterwards, because they will have a weakened infrastructure. In 81, Reagan provides aid for Israel to ship hundreds of arms to Iran for this war against Iraq. In 82, the U.S., Israel invades Lebanon against the Palestinian uprising. Is that the first Intifada? 79 or 80, Sarah? Okay. And in 83, I mean, there is just more, but the CIA really helps plans to overthrow or kill any prominent leader that is pro the people, that stands up against imperialism. And here in '83, the CIA just kills General Ahmed Dilimi, who was against the pro-Moroccan monarchy and who was leading an uprising against him. In '95, it's the same thing. U.S. attempts to assassinate the Sheikh Mohammed Hussein Fadlaha, who's a Lebanese Shiite leader. In '87, U.S. Navy dispatched to prevent Iran from cutting off Iraq's oil shipments. Here we go, talking about oil again. In 1990, Iraq wants to reclaim the land that was stolen by the U.S. partitioning of Iraq. U.S. and Britain partitioning of Iraq when they made the Kuwait. And then because this is late in 1990, in the fall of the Soviet Union, the U.S. asserts itself and intervenes militarily to reconquer the territory, which there is a huge amount of oil concentrated in the southern part of Iraq and Kuwait. Kuwait is mainly marsh area, but there is a huge concentration, and that is why the U.S. wants to control that region specifically. As we know, in 91, Operation Desert Storm, U.S. military intervention. In 91 also, because the U.S. has been funding the Shiites from the south and the Kurds in the north from before, there was an uprising against Hussein. But they were afraid that the popular movement had so much... had such a broad base that they gave the aid to Hussein to crush these movements. So it's always against the people, against the popular movements. And we see that with President Chavez in Venezuela, where the U.S. continues to try to overthrow or kill. In 93, there's a military attack. There's bombing. So from 1990, even though it was Operation Desert Storm, it supposedly lasts 42 days, there was just bombing consistently up through now. It never ceased. There was ebbs and flows. Some days were more, some days were less, but it continues. There was 93 more missile attacks. The 95, there was sanctions imposed on on Iran. In 1998, there's the Iraq Liberation Act, which sounds like the Commission for a Transition of a Free Cuba that the U.S. Published, Congress passed, 2 years ago, which given it's $100 million to groups attempting to overthrow Hussein. So this war against terror and an invasion of Iraq has been planned long ago. But it was carried out under auspices of, you know, enduring freedom or terrorism. I mean, here it is in 1998, Operation Desert Fox, which is a joint U.S. imperialist and Britain. This Operation Desert Fox was to destroy Iraq's nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons programs. They had been destroyed. There were none since before. The sanctions, more bombings. So here we are in 2001, 2002, when they're preparing for this war on terror, the axis of evil. There are none. It's all a myth. It's a lie. And then 2001, the operation, you know, the current war against terror, which was launched. So it's again and again a repeating cycle of trying to dominate the land and the resources, which is in the region, it's oil and gas, and it's a significant amount. And I think that's it.
I want to really thank Arturo for that, because that is not easy to do. We're not giving a test or a quiz on any of these facts. But the important point on it is that the present war in Iraq is a continuation of more than 50 years of non-stop interventions, one after the other after the other. And that's just talking about the period since World War II. If we were to do a class today on Latin America, you could do the same thing from the Monroe Doctrine forward. The sheer number of U.S. invasions, coups, coming again and again. You could look at Nicaragua, you could look at Panama, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, and so on, in country after country, every attempt to make change had to contend with the U.S. Marines, a full-scale invasion, a coup, an assassination. And that's what we want to touch on, is that the reason to intervene again and again and again, the real reason is that in one country after another, there were people's movements, popular movements, to control their own resources, their own destiny, their own sovereignty. There were interventions against people's movements, against communist movements. There were against nationalist movements, against religious movements. A whole number of different military interventions which were attempting to put down and crush popular movements demanding control. Now, let's go back to this map. And everybody has one of these maps? Now, this map, I think you have this little map that I copied down here. It's not real, real clear. But you see all these images? They're like oil wells. It's making a very important point. And there are things that look like roads going out of the region from every direction. And those are oil pipelines. See, the wealth, and it's actually on the last page of your chronology, it says 1901 oil discovered in Persia. That's today Iran. So when oil was discovered in this region, it suddenly had enormous interest to the big imperialist powers of the day. On this map up here, you see a little bit more, and afterwards I really do invite people to come up and look at it, because again, it shows both these literal lakes of oil. And that's what they are. They're like underground lakes or pools of oil. And then again, the pipelines that are taking, and also the main shipping lines out of the region, taking this fantastic supply of wealth out of, now this is what we call the Middle East, but it's political, its historic significance changed when this vast amount of oil was discovered here. Now, at the time it was discovered, you could say that this part of the world was also, although it had a very ancient history, going back to, we could go all the way back to Mesopotamia and Babylon and, you know, thousands of years of history. So it's not that there wasn't a high level of civilization, of culture. But in capitalist terms and industrial terms, this whole part of the world was vastly underdeveloped. And it didn't really have yet a working class, such as it does today. But if you're thinking 100 years ago, this part of the world had a great deal of oil, but did not have industrial development. The overwhelming majority of the people were illiterate and were, for the most part, peasants. They lived on the land. So we'll come back to that, but let's talk about why oil is important in the world today. It's just, what does oil do? It runs our cars, right? But what else does it do? Plastic, right?
It runs the military.
Runs the military, it sure does. That's very important in terms of it being a commodity, and you can have monopoly control of that commodity. There are a lot of other corn oil and olive oil and a lot of other products that might be much easier to have access to. And a lot of other ways of fueling industry and living. But the monopoly control is extremely important. Now, before we go on, so it talks about the greatest usage of oil is actually the Pentagon, the military machine itself. It's used in heat, it's used to fuel industry, electricity. It's used in the very clothing we wear. Agribusiness today is impossible without the fertilizers that are made from oil, right? That's extremely important. The plastics, paint. Now, see, and we could take this class in many directions, because if we were doing this class actually as a class also on the environment, it could go in one direction. But just keeping it on at this point, why this is such an important part of the world, that U.S. imperialism would intervene again and again and again and send in troops and send in the CIA and send in aircraft carriers and so on. It is because of the control of this oil. Now, I want to come back to what else it takes rather than just oil in just a minute. But I'm going to ask Arturo to, does everyone have this two-sided sheet? We're just going to look at it for a minute. And Arturo, if you just sort of direct which you're going to start on this side. Okay. So we're going to start on the side with the shorter map. It's world crude oil exports chart.
So I guess we'll get to the top part in a second, but let's look at the bigger box. The world proven crude reserves, actually it's been updated. This is, but this is good enough. It shows, what is that? 694, well, that the Middle East has 64.5%. Latin America, which includes Venezuela, has 11.5%. Africa is 8.9. Eastern Europe is 6.2. Asia Pacific is 4. North America is 2.8. And Western Europe is 2%. Bless you. This really just shows where the concentration of the oil by barrels is. And as you can see by this, is that the majority, overwhelming majority, is in the Middle East. Now, the top part shows that from the Middle East, 43% is exported. But that doesn't mean that all of it is tapped and is being used. That means that 43% of this huge amount of oil is exported. And they have very little that they actually use. And that's, we'll go to, now you can flip to the other side. And that actually breaks down the production and the consumption. If we look at Saudi Arabia, we're looking at 8 million or over 8 million barrels a day. But they actually consume less than a billion. Next hundred, a million. Iran, same thing. 3.5 million and less than almost a million that they consume. So Venezuela, I mean, the same. Almost 3 million. It's a fraction of that. It's only 400,000. Iraq, same thing. 3 million almost, and it's a fraction that they use. So this shows that the majority is being sold off or siphoned off to somewhere else. And we're going to get to that, where it's actually going, which actually confirms what Ardisha was talking about. The UAE, 2 million. And the UAE is one of the poorest countries in the Arabian Peninsula. They use only 135,000. Nigeria, also a poor nation state in the continent of Africa, 2 million, and they use a fraction, a tenth. Kuwait, they use like a fifth. It's the same thing. As we see, until we get to the U.S., the U.S. only has 5 million in production, but they consume almost four times that amount. I mean, this is an older map from 2000. It's actually more than this. So in the U.K., their production is almost the same as consumption. Canada is on par, not as bad as the U.S. They produce 1.5 million, and they consume 2 million. So the strategic goal of the U.S. economy is based not on this oil, on the control, who can control the oil in the region. And the U.S. does consume an overwhelming amount of the oil. And this is actually just on consumption direct. This is not including indirect consumption. For example, if things are made in India, for example, little plastic gadgets that are actually consumed here. Now, if we take all that, it's a lot more. It's a whole lot more. It's about 70% that the U.S. economy is based on oil and oil-based products. From plastics, polyester, rubber, the tennis shoes that you use, for example. That's all petroleum-based. And we're not even including here gas in the region. The gas in the region is actually, we don't have a map for it. Hold on a second.
Anyway, just some of these figures, they have changed, but not really proportionately. So although it's a map from 2000, so it's a five-year-old map, Arturo has a lot more newer figures, but they're a whole lot harder to read. So it still fit the reality. So let's just back up to say then that oil, from when it comes out of the ground as a raw product, to even get it out of the ground takes exploration of quite an incredible level. It takes drilling, which also involves a whole form of technology, right? And then once you bring it up, it takes an incredible amount of pipelines, right, which take other resources. And the pipelines are just to get it to a refinery. And as we saw on this chart, a lot of the oil is moved as crude oil to the industrialized countries, and especially to the U.S. It's refined here. But even to come here as crude oil, it still takes the exploration, the drilling, the pipelines, the ships, the terminals, right, the ports, the super tankers. It's got to be offloaded here. So just to have a picture of all of this has to be maintained, right? So what does all this mean? What do every one of those steps require? Capital and something else. But it also takes labor, right? Okay, but I just want to stay on the labor for a point to just say at every step, in the capitalist system, what happens with labor? Exploitation. Right. So that's part of the struggle going on. At every step in this process of oil from a raw product, it takes an incredible amount of labor. And under the capitalist system, labor, an incredible amount of the value that labor produces, is stolen by the capitalists. They make profit on every stage, not just the oil that comes up from the ground, but they make a profit on every single step of this process. And it's an incredibly complex process. But just to sum up, in talking about oil coming from here, of great interest to a very small ruling class, because if they have a monopoly on it and that they can control and own its development, they make money on it as a raw material, but they're also making money on the labor it takes to refine this oil every single step. And it's thousands of steps, right, from its coming out of the ground. Now, we also said that this part of the world used to be largely peasant and didn't have a skilled working class, right? So what are some of the skills that you would need if you were going to refine oil? Just a few. So you'd need scientists, engineers. And what else? Right. You'd need literacy. You'd need literacy, right? And you'd need a lot of technicians. So scientists, engineers, technicians, but basically they all have to read. So you'd need a large skilled workforce, and you'd need the police force to control them. So if we were to look, actually, on this part of the map, you can see here is an area. If you looked at it, you might say, well, it's a lot of desert, doesn't have much water. 100 years ago, it was largely peasant. And when you take this oil and start pulling it out of the ground, something else happens to the population, right? When you're drilling and piping and refining and you have more and more workers to get to work, it's fleets and fleets of buses that needs drivers. You need not hundreds, you need tens of thousands of mechanics. You've got to do upkeep on these pipelines and on the buses and on every piece in the refinery that has to be overhauled maybe every 6 months. So, in other words, you need a highly skilled working class. And if we went back to this chronology that we did in the beginning, there was something happening. There was a working class growing up that did not exist before, waging many struggles for literacy and for skills and for training. There were revolutions that happened that for the first time set up schools and said, we don't want to just be doing the labor work. We want to be trained as the scientists and the engineers. We want to know how to run these refineries and design the refineries and do the overall maintenance. And in Iraq, with the Iraqi revolution, and then in Iran, that was a big, big part of the demand, that they control this entire industry with their own workforce, It's why in the bombing of Iraq, they not only destroyed the refineries and the food processing, but the schools. hundreds and hundreds of schools were bombed, from universities right down to the grade schools, because a literate and an educated and an organized workforce, that's what they want to destroy. If it can be brought as a raw product here, they feel that the imperialists feel they can control this longer. Now, there's something else that's going on, going back to the police force it took and that it takes, because you can also see, if you see history in terms of change, it's why we can be confident that their days are numbered. Because this is not the part of the globe that it was 100 years ago, or 50 years ago, or even 30 years ago. They may still be drilling and transporting oil, but something else has happened above the ground. Right? And that's where we come in. I mean, collectively, the we, the conscious working class, now understands that this resource is valuable. Do you think when oil was first discovered, the people who lived there even understood it had value? The contracts were all written in Britain or in the U.S., and the local ruling class were told that if they went along with it, they would get, they could become super rich, but there was no provision made for the population of the region at all. So we're gonna have to, I want to spend some time on Palestine, but if you were to look at, and you could do a class, five classes, you could take a whole course on every one of these countries and their struggles. And it was very important what Ardashir was describing about the struggle in Iran, the struggle for skills, the struggle to control those resources, and why Iran is a target today. Now, it's a target not just because of nuclear. They want to develop nuclear industry and nuclear energy, because it's a very important skill and educational level. It doesn't just make bombs. And it can be crucial as the oil begins to run out, too. Will this part of the world just be left a desert? Or will they have industrialization and technology? Iran is doing something else that's making them a target right now, which also Iraq tried to do, even under sanctions. Oil is bought and sold on the world market. How? How do you pay for it? Dollars, right? Every country has to have U.S. dollars in order to buy any oil, to run a car, to run an industry. And that gave the United States enormous leverage anywhere in the world. Even Cuba, to import oil, had to have U.S. dollars, blockaded as they were, right? That was a big, big problem. And Iraq said, we're going to start selling our oil in euros. That was months before the 2003 war came. And it was actually a very important reason back in 1990. That was first Iraq's proposal. That was before actually the euro, but that the investment that, you know, it moved from total dependence on the U.S. It's a longer thing to get into, but Iran has also announced in the coming months they will be buying and selling. They're setting up their own bourse, their own stock market, where oil will be bought and sold and can be done in the euro. Now, that is a big, big threat to the tiny handful, there are 200 billionaires in the U.S. who own more than half the population of the world, own more than 2 billion people. They have enormous power, and they're determined to maintain it. And them maintaining it is keeping the status quo and keeping control of the way things are done now and convincing us that that's the only way it can be. That if you don't have it this way, there's no other way it could happen. And I think this really goes back to your question. How else could it happen? Well, there are many, many other ways that life and industry and human relations can be organized. But the most important step is convincing us that this is the only way it can be organized. And as long as we see it that narrow, you know, that's... Before I switch to Palestine, though, because I do want to spend a little bit of time really on Palestine specifically, but just to... We're sort of doing this whole part of the world as a sweep, beginning with trying to summarize 50 years of history. That was a really difficult job, but it was good. 50 years of history and U.S. interventions and nuclear threats and invasions and assassinations and coup d'etats into a few minutes, but also the growth of a new class that did not exist before and is today literate and educated and has scientific know-how on a very, very high level. Well, it is why we study and why it's so important we study. We look at things in an overview as to what's happening and what are the big changes that are happening. So we talked about here the development of oil as an industry, as a commodity, but also giving rise to a working class that is far more organized, powerful, conscious. And as that happens, it has taken, in this part of the world, to control that oil and the profits and super profits that come from it, more and more and more military force. 50 years ago, were there tens of thousands of U.S. troops in this region? There weren't. And yet, if you especially look at the last 15 years, it has been nonstop war. Before this, sending an aircraft carrier, blasting the capital city, maybe, or dropping a few bombs or assassinating the head of state might have given the change that to keep things going along. But it takes greater and greater U.S. military power to control this part of the world. They're so preoccupied that other parts of the world are breaking free, like we can see in Bolivia and Venezuela. That's very true. For heaven's sakes, these are like, they're for socialism there. Why on earth aren't the Marines invading? And they're running out of the U.S. soldiers to do that.
300 million Americans.
Nobody's enlisting. That's really true. And this is also where we come in. No one, in far, far reduced numbers, the military machine they need to sustain this empire, they can no longer get from here. And so when we see this, it really is a source of enormous optimism on our part. That not only is it more possible for the working class to organize itself, it's also the only solution. If this class were on the environment, the danger of using petrochemicals and endless carbon, we could also be talking about that, because this is a mad, mad, super profitable, but very dangerous for the future health of this entire planet. There are lots of other solutions for how we organize ourselves, but also there's even technological solutions of wind and solar and all kinds of of things that could be done, but it really takes the working class organizing it for that to happen.